You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
The time is now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, April 10th, 2025. I'm your host, Christina Leffring.
And I'm your host, Shali Pittman. In tonight's news, the state Democratic Party chair won't seek another term.
A new investigation tracks the exploding use of bail jumping charges.
And another lingering question from last week's election gets settled.
And in the second half, we'll answer some frequently asked open records questions, hear what's biting in the Madison area, and check in on the Mingo's roller coaster of a season.
All these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
This is Danielle Yawowiecka with the BBC News. Hello. Donald Trump has acknowledged that a period of difficult transition is inevitable as his trade policies continue to cause upheaval on international markets. Speaking at a cabinet meeting in the White House, Mr. Trump insisted that investors were happy. There's been further turmoil on Wall Street, with the Dow Jones Index closing 2.5% down. Our North America business correspondent, Erin Delmore, is in New York.
A lot of what's been going on Wall Street here is a reaction to the president's back and forth over tariffs, a real seeking of solid footing, and they didn't find it today. You know, the markets rallied yesterday. We saw the biggest one-day gains for each of America's three biggest indexes in a few years, some going back as far as 2008. But we also saw a different story today, a lot of stocks going into the red as that sell-off even accelerated. And when they hear the president say that there's going to be a transition cost, they're wondering, have we seen it or does it lie ahead? And if so, how deep will it be?
A helicopter has crashed into the Hudson River in New York City. U.S. media say six people on board, five passengers and a pilot were killed. The helicopter was reported to be carrying a family of five from Spain, including three children. Police boats were assisting in the rescue efforts. The city's mayor, Eric Adams, paid tribute to the victims at a news conference.
At this time, all six victims have been removed from the water, and sadly, all six victims have been pronounced deceased. Again, we're praying for the families and our gratitude to the rescuers and the courage that was displayed and their dedication.
A general strike against public spending cuts in Argentina has severely disrupted transport in Buenos Aires and other parts of the country. It's the third general strike since President Javier Milei took office at the end of 2023. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
It's been quite comprehensive and quite successful, according to the union leaders, the CGT, which called for this strike, representing many unions in many areas. All domestic flights were cancelled. No trains, no underground. Most shops closed. Only the buses in Buenos Aires were working because they belong to a different union. But it's been quite comprehensive, and the unions remain very powerful in Argentina. And from the beginning of the Javier Milei government, they've been fighting his austerity measures.
A Palestinian who was sentenced as a 13-year-old for taking part in a knife attack against two Israelis has been freed after spending more than 9 years in jail. Ahmad Manasra had been arrested in 2015 after he was caught with his cousin Hassan, who had stabbed the two people in East Jerusalem. Hassan was shot dead at the time. You're listening to the World News from the BBC. The artificial intelligence firm OpenAI is suing Elon Musk over claims that he's repeatedly attempted to slow down its business for his own benefit. The company has accused the Tesla boss of using what it calls bad faith tactics to help him control cutting-edge AI technology. Police from the UK's National Crime Agency say 35 people have been arrested in raids on hundreds of shops suspected of being fronts for Kurdish and Albanian organised crime gangs. The operations last month targeted what officials said were cash-intensive businesses that they believe have been used for money laundering and other criminal activities. Ed Thomas reports.
Throughout March, more than a dozen police forces across England took part in Operation Mechanise. Their targets were Turkish-style barbers, vape shops and mini-marts. Increasing intelligence seen by the NCA led officers to suspect they were being used for money laundering, drug dealing and people trafficking. 200,000 illicit cigarettes and vapes were seized during the operation. More than 50 people were questioned for immigration offences, and bank accounts holding £1 million were frozen by investigators. The NCA says it will now try to uncover the organised crime gangs behind the shop fronts.
The American rapper Soulja Boy has been ordered to pay $4 million to a woman who accused him of sexual battery and abuse in California in 2021. Soulja Boy had denied abusing her and said their relationship was consensual. A report into a helicopter crash in South Africa earlier this year has found the accident was caused by an unsecured penguin. The bird, which was being kept in a cardboard box, slid off a passenger's lap and knocked the pilot's controls shortly after takeoff. The aircraft's rotor blades then smashed into the ground on an island near the Eastern Cape. No one was hurt, including the penguin. BBC World News.
This is Christina Leffring and Shally Pittman with your local news, coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. At least 51 international students and alumni in Wisconsin have had their student visas revoked by the federal government, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That group includes 26 people connected with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They're either students or recent graduates working legally under the terms of their visas. Other revocations involved 10 people connected with the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, 4 affiliated with other UW campuses, 10 connected with Concordia University, and 1 graduate student from Marquette University. While some people had their student visas revoked over their participation in pro-Palestinian protests, some lost their standing over minor violations, such as speeding tickets, or for no apparent violation at all, the Journal Sentinel reports.
A Trump administration request that Wisconsin's public schools eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs has run into a roadblock. That roadblock being State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jill Underley. The state's top education official said that the request potentially violates necessary procedural steps and seems intended to intimidate schools with a threat to withhold funds, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Underley, on Wednesday, requested clarification from the Federal Department of Education on the intent and legality of its order, which was issued April 3rd. Schools originally were given 10 days to comply with the administration order, a deadline that was later extended to April 24th.
Ben Wickler, the head of the state Democratic Party, says he's planning to step down in June and won't be seeking a fourth term as chair of the Wisconsin Democrats. Wickler came to the post in 2019 after Republicans had dominated the state legislature and the state Supreme Court for nearly a decade. He used a Republican-written law to expand fundraising dramatically, leading an effort that collected $200 million in 5 years. That money promoted the presidential election of Joe Biden in 2020 and the re-election of Governor Tony Evers in 2022, according to Wisconsin Public Radio. Most recently, the party supported the successful campaigns of liberal Supreme Court candidate Susan Crawford and Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jill Underley.
Crime and punishment were two major topics of TV ads in this spring's state Supreme Court race. Some $27 million worth of television advertising accused both Brad Schimmel and Susan Crawford of shortcomings in the area of criminal justice. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports, citing research from Ad Impact, a group that tracks campaign spending on TV ads. Most of that advertising accused Crawford, a Dane County circuit judge, of giving out lenient sentences. But Schimmel, a Waukesha County judge, was also criticized for his sentencing practices and also for leaving behind a backlog of rape evidence while he was the state attorney general. In the end, the ads seem to have only limited effect, said former Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gieske, who observed that their frequency may have caused viewers to tune them out.
Regulations on unemployment insurance and workforce training programs would be revised under a series of bills being considered in the State Assembly, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. The measures are similar to legislation that Governor Tony Evers vetoed in 2023, the Examiner reports. Assembly Bill 162 would require that state agencies measure the success of workforce training along the lines established in a federal law updated in 2014. When he vetoed a similar bill, Evers said those measurements don't fit the current structure of the state programs or fail to address specific requirements of state law. Three other bills would tighten requirements to obtain unemployment benefits or broaden causes for denying jobless benefits.
A proposal addressing power lines that has divided Republicans in the Capitol has resurfaced in revised form, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The measure would give utilities and transmission companies in the state the right of first refusal to construct new transmission lines that are earmarked for expansion. Supporters of the legislation claim it would save consumers money by spreading the cost of the energy grid expansion to other Midwestern states. But critics in the legislature say the concept is anti-competitive. The consumer group Citizens Utility Board says Wisconsin ratepayers might shoulder expansion costs in other states as a result. Similar bills have been introduced in the last three legislative sessions, and all have failed to pass.
A proposed amendment to the state constitution that would overturn the federal Citizens United ruling in Wisconsin has been introduced by Democrats in the state legislature. If passed, the amendment would reject the concept of Citizens United, establishing that money spent for political purposes is a form of free speech. It would also limit constitutional rights to people and exclude corporations, unions, nonprofit groups, and other, quote, artificial entities. To amend the state constitution, a proposal has to pass in two successive sessions of the state legislature and win approval in a general statewide voter referendum.
And those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Three city council races this spring were decided by less than 200 votes. The closest, a contest to represent Westside District 19, which went to incumbent Alder John Yogeri by just 9 votes in last week's tally. His challenger, Nino Amato, requested a recount, a painstaking, hours-long process that was carried out today. WORT news producer Faye Parks camped out in the Madison Municipal Building to get the official results.
About 30 poll workers hand-counted and double-checked ballots for just over 7 hours today, in a process that kicked off at 9 a.m. One after the other, they reviewed the tally for all 6 wards in Westside District 19. This race was the closest local election this spring. An initial tally last week counted 3,480 votes for Alder Yogeri and 3,471 votes for Amato, a 9-vote difference. With that narrow a margin, Amato could request a free recount, and he did. Amato told WORT today that he owed it to his voters to double-check.
The thoroughness of the review, I think, was one necessary. It validates everything. I think it was ran well. The other thing is, John didn't bring an attorney. I didn't bring an attorney. And the moment you bring an attorney in, you got nothing but headaches. This went smoothly, and that's what we wanted to do.
Acting City Clerk Mike Haas described the process to WORT this afternoon when poll workers were midway through the count.
We reconciled numbers in a bunch of different ways, including looking at the numbers of the voters on the poll list, making sure those match between the poll books. We separate out ballots into absentee ballots and ballots cast at the polls, trying to make sure that the number of absentee ballots matches the number of absentee envelopes. We separate those out, then we eventually start to actually count the votes. And the inspectors then will start to tally the votes for each candidate. We have 5 or 6 tables for each ward, and then we have to combine those numbers and try to see if there's any change from the election day totals.
Candidates can also bring objections to the Board of Canvassers, which oversees the recount and certifies elections.
The candidates are able to give their arguments about why a ballot should or should not be counted, or why absentee ballot certificates either are complete or are not complete. And then the board makes a decision, and then we decide if that decision is going to result in any change in the vote by essentially drawing down or subtracting a ballot from the original total.
Huguer and Amato convened a few times today to consider a handful of questionable ballots, and they agreed each time that the votes should be counted. Here's Amato again.
One of the things that John and I both talked about, we didn't want to disenfranchise any voters, and there was probably a dozen technical errors, but it was either one signature wasn't there or the writing wasn't in the right spot. We wanted to just make sure that the count was the count, so I feel good.
The recount found no discrepancies in the first five wards, but Amato did gain one extra vote in the sixth, Ward 94. That's after a poll worker discovered an absentee ballot where the voter filled in the bubbles beside both Huguer and Amato's names, then crossed out Huguer's. A canvasser convened with both Huguer and Amato, and they agreed that the voter's intention was clear.
We think the tabulator said it was an overvote and probably didn't add it because there were two dots. So we'd like you to...
I only lose by 10.
No. Eight.
Eight. I don't even lose by eight.
I think their intent is clear.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, John.
Okay. Great. Hey. That was the most controversial thing today.
Huguer told WORT that this small change, bringing the margin from 9 votes to 8, made the whole process worthwhile.
I'm glad it's over. I think it's really proof of how well our voting process in Wisconsin works. There's a lot of hard work done here today, and a change of one vote, so it was important. We checked it out, but it's done.
Each of these conversations, Haas tells WORT, were recorded in their minutes for the court to consult in the event of a future legal challenge, along with the envelopes or ballots that they specifically discussed. Just after 4 this afternoon, and with the margin narrowed down to 8, incumbent Alder Huguer was confirmed the winner with little fanfare. The deputy city clerk added the last tallies to a whiteboard at the front of the room. Challenger Nino Amato gave Alder Huguer a hug, and the last stragglers began filtering out. A more eventful recount took place just 2 years ago in the 2023 race between Southside Alder Isidore Knox Jr. and Noah Lieberman. That recount produced an even tie and was decided in Alder Knox Jr.'s favor after a game of chance. They faced off again this spring, resulting in a 141-vote difference and a more decisive victory for Alder Knox Jr. Acting City Clerk Mike Haas says that, in his experience, recounts rarely flip election results.
Typically, in a local election, the margin has to be pretty small, a handful of votes, unless we discover some sort of universal error that happened that was not caught either on election night or at the official canvas. But to try to identify individual ballots or individual envelopes that are deficient is usually a struggle for the losing candidate to find enough to change the result.
Alder Huguer first joined the council last year, unanimously elected by his peers to fill a vacancy. He now heads to his second term, representing Westside District 19 on the council. Elected alders are expected to take office later this month. For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
It's now 6:18 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Thank you.
A new report from Wisconsin Watch and the Capital Times finds that about 50,000 felonies and misdemeanors are charged each year for pretrial violations such as failing to appear in court or curfew restrictions. Last year, bail jumping appeared in 1 of 4 felony charges and 1 in 7 misdemeanors. And Wisconsin is one of the few states with this law. For more, WORT's David Ahrens spoke to Wisconsin Watch's investigative reporter, Natalie Yar.
Today we're talking with Natalie Yar, reporter for Wisconsin Watch. Natalie reported on Wisconsin Watch and the Cap Times that Wisconsin's practice of charging people with bail violations is highly unusual and results in many additional felony and misdemeanor charges. Natalie, you cite two main drivers of these charges, the Wisconsin law and then how it's used. What is the Wisconsin law?
Wisconsin has a bail jumping statute that dates back to 1969 that allows additional felony or misdemeanor charges for anyone who violate any of the conditions of when they're released on bail or on a signature bond. That could be not showing up for court, which is probably how many people think of the word bail jumping, but it could be a violation of any other condition of release, staying away from a certain person, staying away from certain places, not drinking, taking drug tests, possibly obeying a curfew. And any violation of any of those can result in a new criminal charge and multiple criminal charges if there are multiple violations or there are multiple cases open.
So these can be felonies that people are charged with for some of these violations that you described. Is that right?
Exactly. It completely depends on when the person was originally charged with the crime for which they are now out on bond or out on bail, whether that was a felony or a misdemeanor charge. In some cases, these are felonies punishable by up to 6 years in prison, and the misdemeanor, I believe, is punishable by up to 9 months.
Is this law common in most other states?
No. Wisconsin's law is pretty unusual. Analysis I've seen is that there are currently 7 states that impose criminal charges for violating conditions of release other than failing to appear in court. Wisconsin having this much broader definition of bail jumping and criminalizing other types of violations of release is quite unusual.
It's only in the last, say, 20 years or so that there's been a heavy use of it in terms of charging people with felonies. Is that right?
Correct. I think both felonies and misdemeanors. And in the last few years, we've seen an even further spike or an acceleration in that trend. So one of the probably most likely explanations for why this charge has been being used so much more in, say, the last 25 years is a couple of court cases from 1998 and 2008 that settled Wisconsin law. Lawyers say that appears to have then kind of opened the door for this to be charged a whole lot more.
How many felonies and misdemeanors are being charged under this law?
In the last several years in Wisconsin, in total, across misdemeanors and felonies, it's been about 50,000 every year. That makes it by far the most common charge in Wisconsin. If you count, disorderly conduct is the single most common charge in the state, but the two types of bail jumping together far surpass it. Last year, about 1 in every 4 felony cases included bail jumping charges. 1 in every 7 misdemeanor cases also ends up including at least 1, sometimes a lot more, bail jumping charges.
Some defense lawyers believe that these extra felony and misdemeanor charges have proliferated because it's a way of exerting extra pressure on a defendant to plead guilty, because now you're not only being charged with 2, now you may be charged with 4 or 6, however many of these violations that have been incurred during the pendency of your trial.
Defense attorneys absolutely think that is what is happening here. Prosecutors generally will give other reasons for what's happening, or will just say, well, what do you expect us to do? People broke the rules, and that's what this law is for. But yes, defense attorneys will, these charges are actually very frequently dismissed. In Dane County, for example, more than 8 in 10 of these charges end up being dismissed. And so, yes, defense attorneys will say the reason you charged people with it was so that they would now be facing far more charges and far more potential jail or prison time, and then they're more likely to plea, of course. But yes, I did, and I also heard that from people who were facing bail jumping charges, that, you know, in some cases they pled because they were concerned about how much potential time they could get if they faced all of these charges.
A second reason which is given, which is Wisconsin DAs want to enhance the load of felonies that they charge so that they can ask for more staff.
One concern raised in 2007 or so in a Legislative Audit Bureau report was this concern that because of the way that the mathematical formula basically determines how much staff should be allotted to prosecutors' offices is based on the caseloads, that prosecutors would have a reason to inflate those caseloads. The Milwaukee DA, John Chisholm, he did bring up this theory and basically said that he thinks that that's part of what's going on, and that he thinks it's a bad incentive, but that that's the incentive that he and the other DAs were facing. Whole situation should be reconsidered so that that incentive isn't in place anymore.
Are these charges more likely to be made in Dane County than in other counties?
Last year, Dane County charged more felony bail jumping than any other county in Wisconsin.
Advocates for prisoner rights often cite that anywhere between a quarter to a third of prisoners are there as a result of probation or parole violations. Has this practice of felony bail jumping charges contributed to Wisconsin's high rate of incarceration?
And yes, thank you for bringing up the what people sometimes refer to as like crimeless revocation or the rules violations that can land people back in jail or prison. And bail jumping is, I think, has gotten less attention, maybe less studied, but is sort of like the pretrial version of that same thing. It's hard to have a clear answer because anybody who was charged with bail jumping was also charged with something else. If bail jumping is getting more people to plead guilty, then I think we could imagine that some of those people, if they had not pled guilty, might have gone to trial and might found not guilty and might not have ended up in jail or prison for sentences, but it's really hard to say.
Well, thank you very much, Natalie Yar, reporter for Wisconsin Watch, and this report was published in Wisconsin Watch and the Capital Times, and you can go to those sites for the complete reports.
You're listening to Handcrafted Local News here at WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We'll answer some frequently asked open records questions. We'll hear what's biting in the Madison area. And we'll check in on the Mingo's roller coaster of a season.
But now, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash. Have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position.
The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bernie's Rock Shop, located at 901 East Johnson, and our new shop, Bernie's on Park, at 636 South Park in Madison. We offer handmade silver jewelry as well as unique mineral, crystal, and fossil specimens from around the world. Store hours and more information available at berniesrockshop.com.
BBC News with Danielle Jałowiecka. Donald Trump has conceded that a phase of difficult transition is inevitable as his trade policies continue to cause upheaval on international markets. He insisted that investors were happy, but there's been further turmoil on Wall Street, with the three major US stock indices closing down after Wednesday's surge. A helicopter has crashed into the Hudson River in New York City, killing 6 people on board. The mayor of New York said the helicopter was carrying a family of 5 from Spain, including 3 children. A general strike in Argentina against public spending cuts has severely disrupted transport. All domestic flights have been cancelled. Trains and metro services have been suspended in Buenos Aires and elsewhere. A Palestinian who was sentenced as a 13-year-old for taking part in a knife attack against 2 Israelis has been freed after spending more than 9 years in jail. Ahmad Manasra had stabbed the 2 people in East Jerusalem. Thousands of people in the Dominican Republic have attended the funeral of the much-loved singer Ruby Perez, who died when the roof of the nightclub where he was performing collapsed on Tuesday. At least 220 people died. The British government says it will give Ukraine an additional $450 million of military support, some to be spent on new drones and to repair armoured vehicles. British police say 35 people have been arrested in raids on hundreds of shops in England and Wales, suspected of being fronts for Kurdish and Albanian organised crime gangs. Businesses like barbers and vape shops were targeted. Officials believe they were being used for money laundering and other criminal activities. The American rapper Soulja Boy has been ordered to pay $4 million to a woman who accused him of sexual battery and abuse. The unnamed woman sued the rapper, whose real name is DeAndre Way, in California 4 years ago. BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Shali Pittman, here with my co-host, Christina Liefring. Thanks for joining us.
The laws surrounding open records can be confusing to navigate. Exceptions abound, and it is sometimes unclear whether an organization or document is subject to the open records law or not. Feature producer Crowena Crimmins brings this week's edition of Transparency Talk, where hosts Bill Leaders and Tom Kamenick discuss some of the interesting questions they have been asked as advocates for open government. But before we turn it over to Tom and Bill, our standard reminder that this conversation is not intended to be specific legal advice, but rather a discussion of general legal issues. If you have a particular legal issue, please consult an attorney. I can see
clearly now, the rain is gone. Today is every other Thursday, which means it's time for Transparency Talk, the news program that you can see right through. I'm Bill Leaders, and I'm the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, a statewide group that promotes open government. And I'm here with Tom Kamenick, the founder and president of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, a law firm devoted to open government. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Bill, and hello, listeners.
You know, Tom, much of what the two of us do in the service of the cause of open government is to answer people's questions. You probably field more of these inquiries than I do, but I still get several a week. Sometimes it's a reporter looking for a quote or advice. Sometimes it's a citizen who found my email or phone number and has a question. I think it might be interesting to talk about these contacts. So, Tom, what was the most interesting question you were asked this week?
Well, the most recent one I had was about the attorney-client privilege, and that is one that comes up quite a lot. Custodians will cite that in a denial letter. And unfortunately, I have to tell people that is a legitimate exemption to the open records law. So the attorney-client privilege, mostly it's an evidentiary privilege, but it also protects from record requests. And what it protects are communications between a client and a lawyer regarding legal advice that the client is seeking. And it also extends to communications among the representatives of a client about that legal advice. So that will also cover any internal emails about the legal advice that they received. So this often comes up in the context of investigations of employees or officials. So say a school district hires a law firm to investigate a complaint that was made against a teacher at the school. Now, normally documents gathered or created during an investigation and the results of the investigation would be public records. But by hiring a lawyer, that school district can hide that report and that information under the attorney-client privilege. And it's really frustrating because there's not a good reason to hire lawyers just to do an investigation. Now, providing legal advice about what they can do as a result of that investigation is a different question. But the investigation itself doesn't have to be done by lawyers. And whenever government agencies do that, they're spending a whole bunch more money basically so that they can hide it from the public.
That's really interesting. And it's true. The use of this exemption is routinely abused. It's used to shield information from the public.
Just because an attorney gets copied on communications, it doesn't necessarily make it privileged. But you have to see the content to know whether or not it's privileged, and they're not going to give it to you. So it's a really hard thing to fight.
So what else has come up? What's the second most interesting contact that you've had?
I had a question about draft reports prepared by a medical examiner, a coroner, and that brings up the issue of draft documents, which is another one that comes up a lot. There's an exemption in the law for some drafts, but it's not as broad as it's often used by custodians. Now, this exception is only supposed to apply if the draft is made for the person's personal use or they're working for somebody else and making it for their personal use. So, for example, if the mayor drafts a speech, earlier drafts aren't discoverable under the records law. Or if the secretary writes drafts for the mayor, those earlier drafts you can't get either. So this came up in the context of the medical examiner has preliminary versions of their final reports on a death, but that will be protected even if other office employees at the medical examiner's office work on it. It only loses its drafts protection if it gets shared outside of that office, perhaps with police department.
Some of the most interesting stories I've covered as a reporter have to do with drafts of reports that were issued and then they were whitewashed. And then you go back and you see the original report and you see how it was changed and sanitized to arrive often at a different conclusion than the original report. So it's important to be able to obtain these records when possible. So you want to hear one of mine, Tom? One of the things that I've been contacted about?
Let's hear it.
A reporter emailed me this week to ask whether a publicly funded charter school in Milwaukee, known as the Academy of Excellence, was subject to the state's open meetings and open records laws. The reporter said the school was entirely funded with state dollars. I wrote back to say that, you know, that's one factor that can be taken into consideration, but it's not always an easy question to answer whether someone is subject to the laws or not. There's a 2008 Supreme Court decision, the state of Wisconsin versus the Beaver Dam Area Development Corporation, which identified some factors that could be taken into account while determining whether a quasi-governmental entity, as they're called, is subject to the openness laws, including the level of public funding. But the court did not draw any bright lines and made it clear that these determinations needed to be made on a case-by-case basis. So I looked around and I found online there was an AI overview that came up through a Google search, which said that the Academy of Excellence does consider itself subject to the openness laws. And so while I'm not entirely sure based on this result, because AI was involved, I urged the reporter to proceed with that presumption that these are records and that they are subject to the records law and to the open meetings law, and to make a request and see what happens.
Yeah, I often recommend the same thing. If you're not sure if something is subject to the records law, make a record request and see what they say. But here, if the Academy is actually a charter school, which I don't know personally, but if it's a charter school, that's actually a fairly simple question, because charter schools are public schools, period. And they're fully subject to records. And if they have a board that runs them, they're subject to meetings laws. Now, the question can get more interesting when you're talking about private schools that accept voucher dollars, which are different than public charter schools. I've heard some arguments that private schools might qualify as quasi-governmental if they accept vouchers. I think in the end, courts would be unlikely to reach that decision. The vouchers are given to parents. The parents decide where they want to send their children for school. And if an entity accepts government funds indirectly like that, it usually isn't enough to make it public. So, for example, a grocery store doesn't become a government entity if it accepts food stamps. But again, on the other hand, voucher schools do have to file a great deal of paperwork with the Department of Public Instruction. All those reports and those forms would be public records that you can get.
So, Tom, what's the number one transparency issue that people ask you about?
Delay, delay, delay. And whenever I get that question, there's not a great answer. As you and many of our listeners know, custodians have to respond, quote, as soon as practicable and without delay. And what does that actually mean? Well, courts haven't provided a whole lot of guidance on that. And after the recent Friends of Frame Park decision, when clients ask about suing for delay on records, I have to warn them that unless the delay is really egregious, they may not get their attorney fees paid if we file the lawsuit and they just turn over the records and give up right away.
So that's about all the time that we have for today. I'm Bill Leaders here with Tom Kamenek. Thanks to Crow Crameens for producing. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another installment of Transparency Talk, the news program that you can see right through.
Always a pleasure, Bill. And remember, people, if you don't ask, you won't know.
We still have a few more weeks of April, which means that the full fishing season is still a few weeks away. But don't worry, there's still some fishing to be had around the Madison area. This week on Fishy Business, Nate Wegehout and Pat Hasberg take a look at what's biting, as well as a great fishing event for people with disabilities and a reminder of boating safety.
Alrighty, I'm on the line now with Pat Hasberg over at the DNS Bait Shop here in Madison. Pat, it is still April, which means that fishing, we're kind of in that weird in-between time of fishing, which means that there is definitely a lot of fishing happening, but, you know, we're not quite into the summer fishing quite yet. So just sort of right off the gate, you know, game fishing on lakes is currently closed, but there is still fishing to be had on lakes. So just as a whole, sort of broadly, looking at Madison Lakes, what's happening around town?
Well, yeah, like you said, Nate, the game fish season is closed, so no fishing for walleye, pike, muskie. You can still fish for bass, although those fish need to be immediately released, and the action for those fish has been good. Most of the fish you're going to find around town are going to be up shallow, enjoying the water that warms up the earliest. And you can't forget about panfish, especially in a town like Madison. And the spring panfish bite has been great, really. They're doing really well in any shallow area around town, especially Monona Bay down there off the train tracks, and Birmingham Park has been good. Yeah, I mean, other than that, there's not a ton to talk about. If you can find shallow water in Madison, you're likely going to find fish.
Alrighty, and that'll do it for the lakes. Like I said, a couple weeks here, we'll have more to talk about, certainly, when it comes to the lakes. But right now, I want to move over to the rivers. Now, over this past weekend, there was a tragedy over on the Wisconsin River, and our thoughts are with the families of the people affected by that there and everyone affected by that tragedy. So before we go into the rivers, I just want to go over with you maybe some boat safety on rivers, what people should keep in mind.
Yeah, the tragedy certainly is, you know, something unfortunately that happens every year somewhere on the Wisconsin River. And the thing I tell folks is know before you go, right? So online, there's a great resource, the USGS, that's the United States Geological Survey. They monitor the levels of rivers, and so you can go online and you can type in USGS, any lake or river that you want to fish, and you can find out what the levels are and what they are historically. And, you know, in the situation that happened this last weekend, it was really just a matter of some folks that got into some really fast water and they just weren't equipped for it. And, you know, you got to be ready. But of course, the other obvious things are wear your flotation device, right? Make sure you have that stuff. Make sure folks know where you are, where you're headed, and you know, talk to other anglers that are out there too. If they might have had some kind of experience, they're coming in, and they might tell you spots to avoid. But definitely want folks to be careful this time of year because water levels can change. You know, you get big rains or snow melts up north. You don't know exactly what's coming, so do be careful.
And now getting into some of the fishing report part of this, let's start off with the Wisconsin River. What are you hearing happening around there?
Well, the walleye bite and sauger bite on the Wisconsin River has been great. Those fish are stacked up at dams right now. They're a migrating fish. They naturally want to go upriver to spawn on the Wisconsin River and most rivers in Wisconsin. They meet dams and they tend to back up there. So what we had, I think the last time we talked, was a lot of small males hanging out, and they just hang out and wait for the females to show up. And I have heard that the females are starting to show up now. So that action can be great because the females are generally much larger than the males and can provide some great action at really on any river in Wisconsin right now. If you can find a dam, you're likely going to find some fish backed up there.
Now, things are a little bit different when we go to the other side of Madison and hit the Rock River. What are you hearing out of there?
Well, kind of the same thing. I mean, it's a definitely a good walleye bite down there. Both of the dams south of town here at Indian Ford and at Jefferson are great spots to try for some walleyes. And, you know, the both levels on the Wisconsin and the Rock River have been high, but they are coming down. And provided we don't get any serious rains, we should be in pretty good shape moving forward here. And like I said, same thing on the Rock as on the Wisconsin. A lot of females are starting to show up, which provides, you know, some great action for some real trophy fish.
All right, and now let's move over to the trout bite. Now, like I said before, we are still in April, which means it is still catch and release for a couple more weeks here and no live bait. But what are you hearing on the trout bite?
Well, you know, we had some rain there a while back, and that clouded or dirtied the stream up a little bit. But all the streams, from what I hear, are running really great right now. If you're fishing spinning gear, running something like a small crankbait, like a Rapala Husky Jerk or a Countdown's a great idea. Spinners like a Panther Martin also work great, or a small crappie tube jig. If you're running flies, you know, you can always use nymphs and woolly buggers and stuff like that. But this time of year, there's a lot of great hatches coming off. So topwater action can be great. I've been hearing about a lot of blue-winged olives, caddis coming off. And, yeah, it's just one of my favorite times to be out fishing for trout for sure.
All righty, Pat, and that will do it with the fishing report for today. But I actually have a little bit of news, and that is that Fishing Has No Boundaries Madison has announced their weekend this year, their weekend event. Now, Fishing Has No Boundaries is set up to help people with disabilities to get out and fish. They go out to Governor Nelson State Park, and they fish on Lake Mendota every year. And I believe last year they unfortunately had to cancel, but it is on this year for the date of July 12th over that weekend there. And that is a fantastic event. It runs great every year. And if you are someone with disabilities, highly recommend getting, you know, checking it out. And maybe if you are an angler, you can check it out. Or if maybe you're just curious, it's a great event for that as well. Again, that is on July 12th, Fishing Has No Boundaries. And you can learn more about that and register over at FHNBMadison.com. Oh, and I should add, it is also a free event, which is also great. So again, that's FHNBMadison.com. You can find more details and you can register to attend or to volunteer, because they also need volunteers to make sure that the event goes smoothly. Well, Pat, that will just about do it for us here today. Thank you again for talking with me. And remember, you can hear an updated fishing report anytime that you want just by calling one easy, simple to remember number. That's 608-BIG-FISH. Pat, thank you again and good luck out there.
Always a pleasure, Nate. You take care. Good luck, too.
It's now 6:49 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. It's been a roller coaster start to Forward Madison's 2025 campaign. The Mingos have tallied just 3 points of a possible 6 in the league table and crashed out in the second round of the U.S. Open Cup. Andrew and Grant sat down recently with all-time club appearances leader Derek Gibbard to discuss his 5th season in Madison, as well as Friday night's visit to Charlotte and what it'll be like squaring off against FMFC's all-time goal-scoring leader, Christian Chaney. More now from Forward Focus.
Hello again and welcome to everyone listening to WORT Online and at 89.9 FM on your radio dial. This is another edition of Forward Focus, a segment devoted to any and all things Forward Madison FC, Wisconsin's only fully professional soccer team. I'm one of your hosts, Grant Peters, assistant editor for cultural and Forward Madison theme magazine New Dogma Zine. As always, the editor of NDZ and the producer of Forward Focus is Andrew Schmidt. When we last joined you, Forward Madison were preparing to hit the road to take on the Richmond Kickers in this year's first matchup in the coveted Henny Derby on March 29th. In an always hotly contested matchup, Forward Madison would get the scoring going as just before the half in the 40th minute, after a bit of chaos in front of the net, FMFC's Derek Gebhard would find the ball at his feet, and he rifled it home for a 1-0 lead. Gebhard would be back at it again in the 48th minute, as he broke free from the Richmond defense and slotted another one past the kicker's keeper to give FMFC a 2-goal advantage. Although the Flamingos would give one back just 2 minutes later, the defense held the remainder of the match to give Forward Madison a 2-1 victory and their first win of the USL1 season. Last Wednesday, Forward Madison would then return home where they took on USL Championship squad FC Tulsa in the second round of the 2025 US Open Cup. Various changes in the starting 11 led to an inexperienced lineup, and it showed against a talented squad who was a division above the Flamingos. Although Forward was strong defensively at the start, FC Tulsa would break through with 3 unanswered goals in the 21st, 31st, and 51st minutes. Nazim Bartman would pull one back for FMFC in the 68th for his first goal of the season, but in the end, Forward Madison would fall 3-1 and end their 2025 U.S. Open Cup run. Lastly, Forward Madison took on the University of Wisconsin last Saturday in an exhibition match the club has dubbed the Battle for Madison. Forward Madison used the match as an opportunity to get some players some game time and take a look at some trialists, but would find themselves down 1-0. In the second half, Forward Madison's Lori Bell then stepped up to the penalty spot and smashed it home to tie the match at 1 apiece, which is how the match would end as well. For this week's segment, the aforementioned Derek Gebhard, who just kicked off his 5th season here in Madison, joined the most recent episode of the NDZ Live podcast to reflect on the past 5 years, what's changed, and what he loves most about playing and living here in the Mad City. Andrew, take it away.
We have returning to the show the all-time appearances leader for Forward Madison Football Club, Derek Gebhard. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Hey, guys. How are you guys doing? Good to be back again.
This is your 5th season with Forward Madison, your longest tenured club, pro club anyway. So at this point, do you just have like a permanent locker with your name on it? Like no one else can take it. They're going to retire it when you're done. You've officially spent more time at Forward Madison than anywhere else. You got to tell us, at this point, are we getting a testimonial match?
I've been a professional. This will be my 10th year. So yeah, literally like half my career. I've pretty much been here now, which is crazy. After that 2022 season, it was a rough go, but that's when it kind of, they gave me another chance to come back. And that's where I feel like the team itself and myself as an individual has been able to grow since then a lot. Being able to just have, the same staff and also a good amount of the same players staying year in and year out. It kind of just allowed me to mature as a player and as a person, but as a player on the field, just being more comfortable with the formation we're playing, with the players I'm around, and then just getting a lot of chances to play in games, which then, you know, creates that comfort or that feeling of experience where you know you've seen a lot of situations, so you feel a little bit more comfortable in the field. But yeah, that's where I think, like, for me it's what grew a lot for me, is once we were able to have that consistent like players and staff all together working together, that's where I felt like I was able to improve as a player a little bit more and quicker than, you know, if you're in a system where it's changing every year, you know.
So you played for a couple clubs, you know, before this, but as we said, you stuck around Madison the longest. So what is it about this place that keeps you here?
Well, one, I do love the fans. As far as, like, I can remember from my whole career, I think it's been like the best supporting group that I've been like had as a player with any club I've been at. Also, just the staff, the players that I'm playing with, the locker room that we have, that's been a part of it as well. Just being part of the growth that the club and the team has had over the last few years, I feel like that's definitely been a big part of it. The earlier part of my career was a lot. I mean, I was in Jacksonville for a little while, but after that, I was kind of bouncing around for a year or so. And like that's definitely not as enjoyable as a soccer player, like just bouncing around at clubs and having to kind of find a new home every year and maybe new friends, new teammates and all that stuff. So yeah, a big part of it is also just being able to be part of like an actual team that is building every year to get something.
I got to ask, just because the next league game that we have, we go play against Charlotte, except playing against Christian Chaney this time.
Yeah, it's going to be definitely a game that we're really wanting to win, because we know how he is, especially like if they beat us, then he's going to be, you know, thinking he's the best in the world. So we can't have that. We can't have that. So it's definitely a game where like we want to beat them and let them know, like, hey, we'll try and get under his skin a little bit, maybe get him.
I mean, who would know better how to do that than you, right?
Yeah. I'll just keep bringing up FIFA. I'll definitely do it. So
yes. Forward Madison will be back in action tomorrow, as they'll be back on the road to take on Christian Chaney and the Charlotte Independents. Kickoff will be at 6 p.m. local time, and live coverage will be available on ESPN+. Forward Madison will then return to the friendly confines of Bree Stevens Field on April 19th when they take on newcomers Texoma FC in the USL1 home opener. Kickoff will be at 6 p.m. and tickets are now available. Live coverage of the match will also be available on ESPN+. And that'll do it for this week. As always, we hope that you'll join us throughout this season as Andrew and I continue to keep you up to date on all the news, updates, and stories coming out of Bree Stevens Field, as Forward Madison begins their quest for USL1 glory in the 2025 season. For WORT, this has been Forward Focus.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer this evening. Your reporter was David Ahrens. Special thanks to feature contributors Bill Leaders, Tom Kamenick, Corinna Cremines, Matt Knapp, Nate Wiggyhout, and Pat Hasberg, and the Forward Focus crew. Nicole Alley engineered this show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Christina Leffring.
Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your pods. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine with Dee Crouch. Have a good night.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
It's the Perpetual Notion Machine, excuse me, edition April 10th, 2025. Thanks for joining us in this half hour of evening science news. My name is Dee Crouch, and I'm joined here in the studio by Dave Lovelace, a research scientist at the UW Geology Museum.